Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. Happy Sabbath to you. Happy festival season. It's nice to be in this season of the year. The weather is cooperating. People say, the feast is early this year. The feast is late this year. And I always say, no. The feast is always right on time. The calendar changes around, but God always puts the feast exactly when it should be. And as we calculate it, we know when it should come. It's nice to have the opportunity to visit down here. I've been here many times by satellite as I have tuned in to watch services and listen to you speakers and watch you song leaders. Different times I've been cabin bound and not been able to attend services. Greensboro is one that has an excellent data hookup. I learned those that had, you know, really good hookups and audio and video and so on. And it's just something about it that is, well, it's pretty special. And it helps someone who is not able to attend to be able to participate in a service that way. And it is a service. It's not only for those who are in the congregation and at home and not able to get in here to the building, although that is the main purpose for it. I know Mr. Burns is very ill today, and he would like to be here, and he said he'd be tuning in. And I know some international people who are tuning in as well. So special greetings to those of you who are online. Well, the sermon that I have for you today is so dull and boring that I'd compare it to Melba toast, old bread, you know, that you just use up because you don't have any other else around. It's not one that you will say, oh, wow, what a great sermon. I sure am glad that I heard that because now I know everything that I need to know. But I think it is a sermon that should be covered. It deals with a subject that you almost never think of. Except occasionally, and when you do think of it, either you have no idea what the answer is or what the church teaches on it, or you go to the other extreme and you have very strong opinions about what should be done in this area. I've encountered both sections. And that is the subject of the statutes of the Bible that you find in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The church regularly receives questions from people about these, and they're usually from people with a church background. I don't know other churches that believe in or talk about the statutes. And they're usually people who have a long history in the Church of God, who have heard things about statutes or who kept statutes. I can remember over the years traveling and working in various parts of the United States and across Canada, especially during the summer season, receiving fruits and vegetables from members who would say they were bringing their first fruits, and they were talking about a statute. And, of course, they weren't bringing first fruits at all when you understand the statutes. There are probably two reasons why there are such questions coming from the church. One is that in the early years, the Church of God, in its modern iteration, when God began to raise up a large church through Herbert Armstrong's ministry, we had many ranchers and farmers in the church. And because of that, and because the statutes and judgments are largely centered around an agrarian society, some thought that conditions were similar to those in the time of the nation of Israel, and therefore we could follow those statutes. So we preached about them and we talked about them. Now, at two of the ambassador colleges, there were experimental farms, in addition to all of the people in the church who ranched and or farmed. And on those experimental farms, we applied, in what we thought we were applying anyway, the statutes of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The other reason that we have thought about keeping the biblical statutes, or we talk about keeping the statutes, is that upon first reading about them in the Bible, and not just one place, but in many places in the Bible, there seems to be strong biblical backing for keeping the statutes. In fact, it seems it would be wrong not to keep the statutes. And yet, when you read New Testament history all the way through, not just the beginning, you read New Testament history all the way through, you find that the New Testament Church of God did not teach keeping the statutes and did not talk about anyone sinning for keeping the statutes. Why is that? Why is there such a difference? And what does the Church of God teach about keeping statutes today? That's my purpose today, to explain why the Church teaches that only some statutes are binding laws upon Christians. I want to start by going through what appear to be strong biblical indications why the statutes should be kept today. I'll start with one statement that God made to Isaac in Genesis 26. This is really a memory scripture, and probably most of you could cite this from memory, at least part of it. We do use it, maybe wrongly, to prove that the Ten Commandments existed before Moses. You'll see why I say that in just a moment. But this is because of a severe problem in the land of Canaan. Isaac was going to go down to Egypt, as various people in God's family, men that God was working with over time, did do on different occasions. Isaac was going to move temporarily to Egypt, and God did not want him to. It was not time for him to do that. So in Genesis 26, beginning in verse 2, we find God himself saying to Isaac, "Do not go down to Egypt. You live in the land of which I tell you, dwell in this land, stay right here, and I will be with you and bless you. Things will work out here. For to you and your descendants I will give all of these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father, and I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven, and I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed." Now notice the last phrase in particular, "because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." Now we quote that and say that proves that God kept the Ten Commandments. But wait a minute. It says that Abraham kept God's statutes, and this is in Genesis 26. And the statutes were given in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Why is this statement made about Abraham keeping the statutes before the statutes, at least as we think of them, were given? That should raise a question in our minds. We also find statutes referred to in Leviticus 26. Bible commentaries will point out that covenant language of the day commonly included in the document, toward the end of it, a warning as to what would happen to people who broke this covenant. And you find this in the covenant that God made with Israel. You also find it in history, in covenants that conquerors, kings, made with people that they conquered. Leviticus 26, I want to start in verse 3 just to get the context and to pick up on the fact that indeed the word statutes is used, or statutes is mentioned in the context with commandments. Leviticus 26, verse 3, God says, "If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and perform them, then I will give you rain in its season. The land shall yield its produce. The trees of the field shall yield their fruit." And then it goes on through all the positive things that God promises to give on the condition. The biggest little word in the English language, if. And that if is centered on keeping statutes and commandments. Then we go down to verse 14. And we begin the flip side. "But if you do not obey me and observe all these commandments, and if you despise my statutes," very specific language there it seems, "or if your soul abhors my judgments so that you do not perform all my commandments, and then you break my covenant, I also will do this to you." And then follows a long list of curses, and likely you're familiar with those, having heard them or read them, studied them over the years. And if you have not, then it's a good thing to read, because it is the basis or a summary of the covenant that God made with ancient Israel and transferred on to Judah when Judah became a nation. And then God gave Ten Commandments that are included in the statutes, and stated them in two places in the Bible. One of those is Deuteronomy chapter 5. And I'd like to read from Deuteronomy 5, verse 29. And this is a statement God made about Israel after giving the Ten Commandments and before going on and giving something else. Because God knew Israel. He knew the people that he was working with. He knew what to expect from them. Would they be able to do what he wanted them to do? Was God surprised when they failed to live up to being the model nation that he wanted? No, he knew what he was working with and who he was working with. And no, he was not surprised when things did not work the way on paper it was written out, so that it was supposed to work out on paper. I mean the paper that we have in front of us, our Bibles. Deuteronomy 5, verse 29, we begin to read on through verse 31. Oh, that there were such a heart in them, that they would fear me and always keep all my commandments. Oh, he knew that they wouldn't. That it might be well with them and with their children forever. Go and say to them, now this is to Moses, he was to go and say to the children of Israel, return to your tents. But as for you, you Moses, you stay here by me, and I'm going to speak to you all the commandments, the statutes, and the judgments which you shall teach them, that they may observe them in the land which I am giving them to possess. Now, you can't get a higher authority than that for the statutes, right from God's own lips, as it were, God's own mouth, to Moses, his mouthpiece. And then Moses gave them, they're called the Mosaic Law, but only because Moses gave them. Oftentimes when I'm working with people or talking with them or writing to them and they make a thing of the Mosaic Law, I will point out that, well, you know, Moses never really came up with any law or devised one himself. He simply repeated what God gave to him to give. It is from God. Now we move on in the Bible, in history, and again I'm just giving you, first of all, the biblical reasons, and I'll give you more detail as we go along. And I don't want to just read scriptures to you, but I want to build a biblical foundation for why we have thought as we have, and why some people even today will argue very strongly that, oh no, you know, everything, first fruits, land, Sabbath, keeping women away from church for so many days after childbirth, etc., all of these things must be obeyed to the letter as they are spelled out. Let's read what David said to King Solomon at a time when Solomon was just being crowned. You know the history of Israel. David had grown old. He had actually neglected to crown Solomon when he should. And one of David's sons by another wife almost stole the kingdom. But Bathsheba, through Joab's intervention, went in there and talked to David. And David realized, yes, I need to pass the baton, as it were. I need to do the official coronation before I die, lest the kingdom slip away and not go as I promised. So he said this to Solomon. This is how he wanted Solomon to conduct himself. 1 Kings chapter 2. Part of David's final words, part of his instructions to Solomon. And, of course, it represents some of the strongest things in David's mind. What do you say to your son as you're about ready to die, your last words? And it's not just a family heritage you're passing along, but a kingdom. Very important. Chapter 2, verse 3. And keep the charge of the Lord, or the Eternal your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his judgments, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. Now, the law of Moses, you know, are the first five books, the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, especially the last four contain what we refer to or think of as the statutes. That the Lord your God may fulfill his word which he spoke concerning me. He said, if your sons take heed to their way, to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul, you will not lack a man to sit on the throne of Israel. Of course, David's sons did not follow through and keep all of that. And God kept his word as long as he could. And then he was not able to keep a man on the throne. But we believe that there is a man available for the throne, even to this day. So in that way, the word is kept. Now, another way to look at the statutes is to look at it looking back from why God allowed his people to go into captivity. Now, the obvious reason is that they failed in becoming the model that he wanted them to be. oftentimes we receive letters from parts of the world that we call the developing world. Some people call it the third world or the fifth world, but the world that's not living by Western standards. And they will say, why is it that God likes the West so much and doesn't like us so much? Why is it that God always liked, especially, Israel? And the answer is that God wanted all nations to have all of the blessings. He just wanted Israel to be a model so that people would look at it and say, wow, look how well that nation does. Let's find out what their government is. Let's find out what their gods are like, because people thought in terms of gods and religion quite readily. And then, you know, let's worship the gods of this particular nation. And that way the all nations would be led to the true God, and all nations would be led to the blessings that God would like all people to have. Well, God found that Israel was not able to do that. And I'm speaking of the Israel that broke away from Judah and became a separate nation, the 10 tribes in the north. And eventually, after sending prophet after prophet to them, Isaiah being one of the last ones to go to them, he allowed them to be taken into captivity by the Assyrians. Then Ezekiel was sent after the fact to prophesy to Israel about them going into captivity after they already went. And this is a very interesting part of the Bible, showing things how God thinks. He wants us to know why that happened. He also wanted Israel to know why that happened, because Israel, or Ezekiel, was talking to the Israelites who were around him in captivity. And I just cannot ever get over the fact of how important geography remains to this day, because apparently where Ezekiel lived, walked, preached, is right where the people that we call now ISIL broke through the Syrian border and went into Iraq, right up around the area of the river Euphrates, the beginning of the Tigris-Euphrates area. That is the area where insurgents came through the Syrian border and troubled Iraq when the American coalition armies were in there. And it has been a place in biblical history from the beginning. Abraham traveled through there. I think Dr. Schwartz gave a sermon about that. A very important area in history. Well, let's look at that in Ezekiel chapter 11. Talking to Israel after the fact, but as we know, it is a prophecy, a warning for Israel in the future. That if Israel does not do what God wants in the future, Israel will face the same potential penalty of captivity and scattering. Ezekiel chapter 11, just one verse, verse 12. You shall know that I am the Lord, for you have not walked in my statutes, nor executed my judgments, but have done according to the customs of the Gentiles, which were all around you, all the tribes of the people around Canaan. God did not want them to influence Israel, did not want Israel to follow those gods. We know this scripture in Exodus that we often quote in regard to the customs of Easter and Christmas. Don't inquire about how the other people worship their gods. Well, Israel failed to do that, and they follow the other gods. And in that context, God himself, again, mentions statutes. Well, then we turn to Judah. God turned to Judah. Began to work with Judah, tried to work with Judah, tried to use Judah as the model nation. Same story. It failed. And after being warned from the prophets and after being punished and being defeated by armies at different times and then being rescued, eventually it went into captivity in Babylon. Jeremiah was one of the last prophets there, and he was left behind, actually. I want to turn to Jeremiah 44. And read what God said, again, his own words, to his prophet Jeremiah about the nation of Judah in regard to statutes. Jeremiah 44, verse 10. They have not been humbled, people of Judah, especially the leaders of Judah, to this day, nor have they feared. They haven't feared God as they should have. They have not walked in my law or in my statutes, that I set before you and your fathers, set before the people of Judah, and the fathers of Judah, of course, would go all the way back to Moses, for whom he gave them. For thus says the Eternal, the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I set my face against you for catastrophe and for cutting off all of Judah. Now that is, you know, many strong statements from the Old Testament record. If you go to the New Testament record, there's not a lot said about the statutes, but some could argue that Jesus even supported the statutes, because if you remember, on one occasion, he healed a number of lepers, and then he told them to do what? He didn't just say, go about your business. He said, go show yourselves to the priests according to the law of Moses. So it seems that Jesus Christ supported the statutes in that regard. And then the Church of God seemed to struggle over this for a number of years, because when Peter had his vision to go to Cornelius, and Cornelius, a Gentile, was added to the church without first becoming a Jew, without first becoming circumcised, the members of Cornelius' contingent came to Peter's house, where Peter was staying with Simon the Tanner, and they asked Peter to come and visit them, and Peter said, well, you know, it's unlawful for me to do so. Now, I don't know if he was talking about just Jewish custom, or if indeed he was struggling and the Church of God was still following the statute about not associating with people of a different faith. The Church seemed to struggle for a time with that. So, summary, there's good reason to keep the statutes, so it seems, from the Bible. Except, again, how many times are statutes mentioned in the New Testament? Beyond those two places that I mentioned right at the beginning of the New Testament history. No places. Not the Apostle Paul, not Peter and James and John, not in the book of Revelation. There's not talk about statutes. There's much talk about God's instruction and his laws and his ways. Well, how could that be? How could something that is brought up so much in the Old Testament in such strong language seemingly be dropped? The absence of the mention of most of the Old Testament statutes should tell us that there's more to know about this subject than just what appears on the surface. If you take it only at face value, it seems as though the statutes are a unique and a permanent body of law. You have the Ten Commandments, and you can go and you can read in the Bible, you can take them, you can put them up on a plaque on the wall, and it also seems like there's a place in the Bible to go where there are the statutes, and if you wanted to, you could also put those in a plaque form, although there are a lot of them. You'd have to have several plaques or maybe a book and put it on a desk or something. And it seems that there is a separate body of law. But that is not the case, as I will show you. What is a statute? What does that word mean? We have to dig into this to be able to get at the root and to be able to understand it. The Hebrew word for statute is a noun. It means an ordinance. It means anything prescribed. It serves as the feminine of hog, I think is the way to pronounce it. I don't know the anglicized Hebrew. I don't know if anybody speaks biblical Hebrew anymore. And this is from, by the way, Zodiades' Dictionary of the Bible, Complete Word Study Bible. Since its basic meaning is not specific, the word takes on different connotations in each context. Now, you catch the significance of that. The meaning of statutes is not specific. So it's not the same as the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are most specific. And it seems like we have read many scriptures where it says these statutes, it seems to be most specific. But according to this authority who has studied the meaning of the Hebrew in the Bible, he says the word statutes takes on different connotations according to the context. Its most common meaning is decrees. And Zodiades usually translates the word as decree instead of statute. Or it can be translated statute. It is a synonym of these words. The decrees of the Lord could be oral, or they could be written. and they made God's will known and gave divine directions to his people. That's the most important aspect of a statute or an ordinance, or as you have heard me mention the word, judgment. You'll also find the word precept used many times in the Psalms, sometimes in the Proverbs. I didn't read any of those scriptures, but that is a similar word as well. And God said to keep all of those. Does that mean that we have to look them all up and write them all down like the Ten Commandments and memorize them and keep them in that way? What it means is we keep God's will. They make known his will. As far as the background of Genesis 26, the Bible knowledge commentary, David C. Cook, says, "All this God said because Abraham obeyed him." Literally, obeyed my voice. Abraham kept my statutes, my judgments, my commandments, and my laws. That means Abraham obeyed my voice. And then Cook adds this interesting statement. These are standard terms in legal literature of the Old Testament. When you're talking about God's voice, you know, there's such a thing in lawyer language and legal language as boilerplate language. There is boilerplate language in talking about the Old Testament. When you're talking about the law, you will find these statements: judgments, commandments, laws, and statutes. The intent of the legal language is what we want to look at. The intent. And it is to obey God's voice, to do whatever he tells you to do. Well, doesn't God tell us to do a lot of things in the statutes? Yes, he does. One of the reasons why it is difficult and indeed impossible to keep many of the statutes today is that some of them were given to counter specific problems that were going on at the time. For example, in Missouri right now, in Ferguson, Missouri, there might be a specific statute given as far as a curfew because of the trouble that is happening right there. Now, it is a decree, or it is a statute, or it is an ordinance, and to defy it is breaking the law. But it is given for a specific circumstance at the time. There's commentary about this fact right within the statutes themselves. Turn to Leviticus chapter 20. Right in the heart of them, and this is God's comment through Moses himself about these statutes, Leviticus 20, verse 22 and verse 23. "You shall therefore keep all my statutes and all my judgments," and the judgments are decisions based upon the statutes. You go to a court and a judge weighs evidence, or a jury weighs evidence and then makes a decision based upon that, or gives judgment based upon the law. And you study case law, you study judgments that have been made on the basis of similar situations that you're faced with right at the moment, so you know what the law requires you to do. That's what judgments of God show you to do. "You keep all my judgments and perform them, that the land where I am bringing you to dwell may not vomit you out." Very graphic language from the Hebrew. "And you shall not walk in the statutes of the nation which I am casting out before you, for they commit all these things, and therefore I abhor them." Some statutes were given specifically to counter the statutes or the practices of the cultures of the people around them. And therefore, at times, in order to understand the statutes, you have to go to a commentary or a book of biblical history, a Bible study, a Bible dictionary, and look at what was going on in the tribes who lived around Israel at the time. We'll get into some of that as I give you some examples towards the end. In Deuteronomy chapter 12, I want to show you an important point about the statutes, in that God gave them specifically to the nation of Israel. Israel right now is not a nation. Now there's the nation of Israel, the nation state of Israel over in the Middle East. That's a nation. America is Israelite, it is a nation. Britain is Israelite, it is a nation. But all of Israel, all the descendants of Israel, are not a single nation. Israelites are scattered all over the world. and have been for most of human history. But there was a time when all of the Israelites lived in one geographic area, and there was a time when its king was God. And it was at that time that God gave Israel these statutes and then judgments based upon them. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 1. These are the statutes and the judgments which you will be careful to observe in the land which the Lord God of your fathers is giving you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. That sounds like a repeat of the statute language given beforehand, but that is not the case. Again, going to David Cook in the Bible Knowledge Commentary about this verse, he notices that the decrees and the laws that follow Deuteronomy 12, verse 1, and let me back up for just a second. If you read the book of Deuteronomy, it's a wonderful study. Moses speaks it as if he's speaking to the first Israelites who came out of Egypt, even though he's talking to the children who came out of them, and it's 40 years later. It's a wonderful repeat of the history, and it's a condensation of what went wrong and what needed to go right. So he really emphasizes the main points. However, when he gets to these statutes, you find, as Cook notices, the decrees and laws that follow this section of speech in Deuteronomy 12, verses 2 through 26, all the way through, Deuteronomy 12, verse 2 through chapter 26 and verse 15, they are not meant to be exhaustive. Moses intentionally did not repeat many of the details and many of the laws recorded in Exodus and Leviticus. How could that be after all that we read earlier about these statutes? Moses did not repeat all of them. Deuteronomy is law preached, or better, it is instruction. Moses was setting a quality of living before the nation rather than an exhaustive law code that covered every detail of life. That's the end of the quote from that commentary. And that shows us really God's intent with the statutes. He was setting a quality of living, a way of life before Israel, rather than trying to get them to go 35 miles an hour in a school zone and 25 miles an hour through a homeowner association development, etc., very specific detailed laws. And that approach is more in keeping with Jesus' teaching about the spirit and intent of the law. Remember in the Sermon on the Mount, how often he emphasized that point. You have heard it said, but. And then he would go on and the but would get into the spirit and the intent, what was behind the law, so that people would not get hung up on the minute details, the minutiae, and see whether they were keeping the minutiae. I want to give you some clarification about the statutes that God commanded Solomon to keep. Remember David's last words? Almost on his deathbed, he died very shortly thereafter, and he said to Solomon to keep the statutes. According to David Cook, Solomon was encouraged to be strong, to keep the word of the Lord. He would show himself to be a man by being brave, to stand for the right, to stand against the wrong. He should observe what the Lord requires in the sense of obeying Yahweh. What the Lord requires is to walk in His ways, namely to keep His decrees, and that word could be translated ordinances, and it could be translated statutes, to keep His commands, His laws, and His requirements, and another word that's used is testimonies in the Old Testament for these things that God has spoken. These four words, decrees, commands, laws, and requirements refer to the different kinds of precepts in the Mosaic Law. Solomon should have been faithful to the spiritual intent of God's words, in other words. And of course, he was not. He failed in many, many ways. Statute, therefore, is not a unique word to describe a unique body of law in the same way that Ten Commandments means. It's different. You have to change your thinking on that. Many of the statutes that God gave to Israel and later Judah were not universal laws that applied to all of mankind. Now, if God governed the entire earth, I don't know what statutes he would have given to people living in Japan or people living in Russia, you know, what he would have adapted for their culture. I don't know what the people around different nations were doing that God would have had to counter. But I do know that he had to counter certain things in Israel and gave laws appropriate to that. We can't even follow the laws in America that were given 100 years ago. You ever do that for fun? You read that in a newspaper sometime. You don't read it in newspapers anymore. You read it on the internet. But you go back and find out what the laws were 100 years ago. We used to joke when I lived in Pasadena that it was still a law on the books that you could not shoot a buffalo from a moving train in the city of Pasadena. I guess if you got off the streetcar, you could shoot the buffalo in Pasadena at the time. But this was in the 1960s still. That law was on the books. America is not governed now by laws that it was governed by just a few years ago. One sad example is the laws pertinent to marriage. It used to be against state law in most states, if not all states in the Union, to commit adultery and to commit sex outside of marriage, to involve yourself in sexual intimacy outside of marriage. It used to be that was the law. And now, of course, the law has changed and been redefined so that people can marry in many different ways. National laws change. And the national laws that applied to Israel do not apply directly to all of Christianity today any more than all of America's laws apply to all Canadians or all Mexicans or all British people or all Russian people, etc. They were national laws. Now you say, well, wait a minute, they came from God, though. Yes, they did. And there's a value in that, and we'll get to that. Many of the statutes related to religious practices, and the commentaries, as I said earlier, can be helpful about that sometimes, but even they cannot always tell you why God gave certain statutes. They just don't know. I have learned in answering questions for the church for several decades now that sometimes the answer is, we don't know. You know, if you don't, that you better say that, right? Rather than shoot the breeze, rather than make something up. You get yourself into trouble when you try to fill in the blanks if God really does not say. Now, sometimes God gives the intent and you can get the general idea. Sometimes you simply cannot. And that is true about some of the statutes. Moreover, completely keeping many of the statutes required the priests. Remember, Jesus said that the lepers go to the priests and be cleansed according to the Mosaic law. In order to keep the statutes to the fullest letter, you had to involve the priest. If there was mold in your house, the priest had to come to inspect it. Right down to, even if it had to be torn down, he had to come and inspect the stones afterwards. If you had a sore on your body that might be a certain type of skin disease, not necessarily the leprosy that we know of today, but the word leprosy is used there, you had to go to the priest to have that inspected. And if a man thought his wife was unfaithful to him and he was jealous about his wife's behavior, she had to go and appear before the priest, and he gave her a certain concoction to determine whether she was faithful or faithless. And if she died, she was faithless. You know, she was an adulterer. And so on it goes. And we do not have a priesthood today. So even if you wanted to, if you believe right down to your tippy toes that every statute should be fulfilled, you can't do it. You don't have a priesthood. And people who brought cucumbers and zucchini by the tons to ministers over the years from their gardens and said, you know, we're giving first fruits, thought they were keeping a statute. But what did the statute say? To whom did the first fruit go? The priest. The priestly families then used it. If the priest himself was not able to use it all up, the Aaronic priesthood then gave the leftovers to the Levitical priesthood. And their families lived on some of the offerings and the first fruits and firstlings and so on that were brought to the temple. But the ministry of God is not the priesthood, never has been, does not stand in for the priesthood. There is one priest, that is Jesus Christ. And ministers today are servants of the priest. And that's what the word minister means. It comes from diakonos in the Greek. It's the same word that's the basis of the word deacon. The office is very similar. And, of course, as you know, biblical history, the office of apostle was split. And the office of deacon was split off from that. For all of the above reasons, the church teaches that most statutes are not binding laws on Christians today. Now, I've used the word some and I've used the word most at different times. Let me explain that a little bit more now. Some statutes were laws before they were stated as statutes, and or they were stated as laws after they were stated as statutes. They include, obviously, the Ten Commandments. They existed from the beginning. They define God's nature. They define God's expectation for our behavior, how we take on the nature of God. There's absolutely no question about the binding nature of the Ten Commandments. Also, and how we find out these things, we have to look at what the New Testament church did do and look at their example. And what did they do and why did they do it? They did it because Jesus taught them to do it. He taught his disciples, this is what you should do after my death. And indeed, after his death, he never left the church. He said, I'll always be with you. And as they prayed for guidance, he guided them in these things. What did they do? They kept the Passover and the holy days. Now, they're given in Leviticus 23, which is part of the statutes. Now, you could stop me here and you say, wait a minute. The priests were involved in those too. Because there were sacrifices. And there have been sermonettes given during the Feast of Tabernacles about how there's so many bulls slaughtered on the first day of the feast, and then fewer and fewer and fewer down to the last great day. There were so many sacrifices that were offered, and that's true. The holy days, as they are revealed, and the festivals, including the Passover, are mixed in with the priesthood. So it is possible to take part of a statute out of where the priests were involved and continue to keep it. Well, why don't we do that with all of them? Well, I'm not the one who makes the rules. I can't tell you all the why. I can tell you the what. I can look at the New Testament church and see that they took the Passover and they took the days of unleavened bread at the instruction of Christ and the example of Christ, and Pentecost. Obviously, God gave his Spirit on Pentecost and made clear that was the day to be kept. And the Apostle Paul wrote about wanting to be at Ephesus for Pentecost, and he warned about traveling through the Mediterranean on the Day of Atonement because the fast is past and it's winter weather already. The church kept the feast days and the festivals. The church also observed tithing. Now, tithing is a combination of administrative decision and law. I'm not going to get into branching off on this too much, except hopefully to get you to think, because some people get very strong-minded on the subject of third tithe, and they read Deuteronomy 14 towards the end and the first few verses of Deuteronomy 15. But if you read that very carefully, what it says is the third tithe was given to the priest in the town where you lived. And the priest kept it, and then the priest decided who received it. It doesn't say how he decided. And it doesn't say whether all the priests were honest. And we have one biblical example in Nehemiah's time where the man in charge of the room right at the temple that was supposed to be the room where third tithe was collected was not faithful. And he moved out all that stuff and used it as an apartment for his buddy. And Nehemiah came back and cleaned the place out and got third tithe back there. But I just want to make the point that third tithe has always been a combination of law an administrative decision that was left up to human servants. So we should not be surprised that that is the approach that we take towards third tithing in the church today. It is a combination of law and administrative decision by God's servants. The other laws that were statutes that were also kept by the New Testament church are the food laws. And we made the argument, and rightly so, that the human body has not changed. What was unfit for food in the past is unfit for food now. Why aren't people dying because they're eating unclean food? Well, we are dying. We're terribly sick people. There's going to be medicine practiced and research done for the sake of dealing with diseases until Christ returns and changes the entire orientation. The cutting edge, I want to explain, is a cutting edge difference between statutes and law. And this is the thing to affix in your mind that will help you know how to decide what to do. The difference is between principle and law. A principle guides how you think, guides how you make a decision. A law tells you what decision to make. Which day will I keep for the Sabbath? No, that's not a question. There is a law that tells you which day you keep for the Sabbath. How will I keep the Sabbath? That requires decisions. It requires judgment. Can I do this on the Sabbath? Well, you know, Christ spoke about certain chores that were done by farmers or ranchers, so some routine things need to be done on the Sabbath. What's routine about my responsibility that would not be breaking the Sabbath? He also talked about an ox in the ditch. Now, most of us don't have oxen and ditches and so on and that to worry about. Now, how do you apply that today? It requires judgment. And the judgment is not something that you can find in the Bible and say, well, you know, I work for AT&T, and let's see, I have a $5 million contract, and the boss says he needs me for 1 hour on a teleconference call on the Sabbath. Is that an ox in the ditch? You cannot turn to a place in the Bible that tells you what to do on that. You have to use your judgment based on the principles of the Bible. The statutes, even though some of them you don't know what to do with because they're just out there as far as we don't know what the people around we don't know why God said them. And some of them, because we're not in the same circumstance, don't apply. But many of them can be applied as we look at the intent. And that is what Herbert Armstrong always used to teach about the statutes, by the way. I have heard him in person. In person. A Christian should study the intent of what God said, and as much as possible apply the intent of what God says, because there was a reason why he said it. However, again, to emphasize, a law requires specific action. That's the difference. In the New Testament church, there's no evidence that the church ever said that keeping or failing to keep a statute, rather, was a sin. And that is what breaking the law is, right? Sin is the transgression of the law. If the statutes were binding laws, then therefore breaking them would also be sin. And we would read of it in the history of the New Testament. We read of it up until the time of Cornelius becoming a part of the church and the church working that out. And I'll get to that in a few moments. But other than that, the church does not speak of it as sin. So there's the cutting edge difference. The difference is between principle and law. Now I want to talk about a couple of sample letters that we have received from people. And they may be Church of God people. I have changed the wording a little bit. One of these may have come from one of you. I'm not using it to demean you. Or if somebody hears this and it came from you, I'm not using it to demean you. I'm just using it as an example. I'm using these because they are good examples, because they are questions that have often been asked of me in person as well as of the church in writing. Letter number one was an argument for observing Numbers 15, verses 38 to 41. And this is a law that requires Israelites, or did require Israelites, to wear tassels on their clothing. Now, you may have seen people who associate with Messianic Jewish organizations have an outer garment on their clothing that has tassels on it. And the reason for that is because of this statute that's found in Numbers 15, verses 38 to 41. I'll just read that. Speak to the children of Israel. Tell them, these are God's words, tell them to make tassels on the corners of their garments and throughout their generations. That's an extensive, expansive phrase, throughout their generations. And to put a blue thread in the tassels of the corners. And you shall have the tassel that you may look on it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them, and that you may not follow the harlotry to which your own heart and your own eyes are inclined. We would say, to which your human nature is inclined, that you may remember to do all my commandments and be holy for your God. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God. And that is an imprimatur. That's like the red stamp that the government official puts on a document or an attorney puts on a document. God makes a very strong statement. He finishes it off with, I am the eternal your God. I am the God who brought you out of Egypt. That's a very strong statement. So then, why don't we wear tassels on the garment? The underlying principle here is what? Very clear from God's own words. People should live by God's commandments. Where are God's commandments today? They're written on our hearts. They're on our minds, as opposed to stitched in blue, it's not fabric, is the word I'm looking for, thread, as opposed to stitching blue thread on the edge of our garments. Some Jewish organizations, some Jewish groups have the Ten Commandments written on plaques and they put them on the outside of their front door. Many times visiting people in Montreal, which had a high Jewish population, I'd enter a door and the church member would be renting an apartment that had been owned or used by a Jewish person at one time, and here on the door are the Ten Commandments in a metal frame. It's only about that long. It doesn't take very much Hebrew to write the Ten Commandments. I don't read Hebrew. I don't know if it was a summary or what. But when they come into the apartment, they touch the Ten Commandments. And when they leave the apartment, they touch the Ten Commandments to remember the Ten Commandments. Well, did they remember them and were they keeping them? No, not at all. That is what God wants His people to do. Keep the Ten Commandments. He doesn't want us necessarily to have them written all over the place. Can you have a plaque that has the Ten Commandments on it? Sure you can. But do you have to wear a garment that has tassels, that has blue thread hanging out, so you can look at it and remember the Ten Commandments? You probably better not. The people whom I've known who have done that have been quite distracted from the real issues. And they make a religion out of the statutes. There's the problem. And by the way, if you're familiar with Messianic Judaism, people talk about, quote, what the Jews do. And I always smile when I hear somebody say, what the Jews do. There are as many divisions, and I'm generalizing, there are as many divisions in Messianic Judaism as there are among the Protestant churches. There's a great deal of variety in Judaism in terms of what, quote, the Jews do. So, you want to research when you hear somebody says, this is what the Jews do. There are Jewish customs. There are even two official Talmuds. You know what the Talmud is? The Talmud is the written down law that the rabbis only spoke for generation after generation because it was sacred. It couldn't be written down. So they spoke it. But sometime in the 5th century, 6th century, after Christ, 6th century A.D., a group of Jews, Masoretic Jews, a group of rabbis decided they would pull together all the traditions and put them down in writing. And they did, and they created a Talmud. You ever play the game 20 questions and pass one question or one statement around the room and then try to get the same statement at the end of 20 people after it was passed around. It's impossible to exactly the same statement. And you can imagine, you know, what God said being passed generation after generation down through all of these different rabbis in many countries, in many cultures, throughout the entire world for thousands of years. And the rabbis took years of arguing over, oh, should we put this tradition in or should we put that tradition in? And finally they came up with a Talmud. It's only a few months ago that I learned that there's a second official Talmud because there's so much disagreement amongst the Jewish community about what really should have been put in there in the 500s. So there are two Talmuds. It's just good to know that about when you say this is what the Jews do. It's not just what God said about, you know, tassels on the garments. Some statutes were given to keep Israel from worshiping customs of local pagan tribes, such as Leviticus 19:27. You shall not shave the sides of your head, nor shall you disfigure the edges of your beard. Is it all right to trim your beard these days? Well, not only is it all right, it's a nice thing to do. It's a polite thing to do to groom yourself that way. Can you have kind of a rounded haircut shape? Well, frankly, that's a common style with men. And with men like myself, who is balding in the typical way, I'm going to have a rounded shape here whether I want it or not. But what was happening at the time is among the local tribes, they were worshiping the sun. And men cut their hair in a way that resembled the sun. Some of them shaved a circle in the top of the head. Hey, that reminds me of a certain religion, even today. Some cut their beards in a round way. Some cut their hair in such a way that to them looked like the sun. I don't know if any of them spiked it out and had waves of the sun or anything like that. But sun worship was involved, and that's what God had in mind. Don't cut your hair the way they're cutting their hair because it's sun worship. What do you do today? What does it have to do with haircuts? Nothing. It has to do with sun worship. Don't worship the sun today. And we don't. We don't worship on the day of the sun. We don't worship on religious holidays that are really basically sun worship. And we have stepped back from the sun worship that much of modern religion has gotten itself involved in. And therefore, we are applying what? The principle, as opposed to a law. Letter number two asked about the land Sabbath. Is there vodka or something up here? Yes. Just kidding. Letter number two asked about the land Sabbath, and this is a common question. Leviticus 25 mentions keeping the Sabbath. It is a statute. And it commanded that the land should be rested every seventh year. And people want to do that. I knew a couple in Canada who had farmed the same area. It wasn't a large farm. It was just their own vegetable garden for 42 years. And in those 42 years, every seventh year, they let it go fallow. And they believed they were keeping this law and that, therefore, things were better for them because of it. And it was. It was better for them because of it, and I'll explain why. There is an underlying principle that can be applied today. The entire law cannot be applied because, again, it was a nation. The entire nation kept the same law in the seventh year. Now, today, how would you do that? Would you say, well, the Church of God is keeping the seventh year this year? Oh, well, I just planted my crops last year, or I just bought this farm, or my whole livelihood is out there in this corn, or these soybeans, or whatever. And, by the way, how does it apply to me? Because I do work for AT&T, and I'm a programmer. What's the seventh year for me? You know, how does the statute apply? You have all of these questions because we are not an agrarian society. It is not in the 13th century or 12th century B.C. when God was the sovereign over Israel. The basic principle is valuable in terms of resting the land. And horticulturalists recognize this today. Properly followed, they rotate crops. They put crops in that put nutrients into the soil that the crop that they have been growing has been taken out, or they let the land lie fallow. Now, there is a practice in Western U.S. and Western Canada of letting the land lie fallow that is not actually in line with this, and that's where they plow the land and just leave the soil open. The wind comes and blows the soil by the tons in the springtime when, in those areas. But that's not letting, that's not following the land lying fallow. If you read the law, it was to let whatever will grow volunteer to grow. One of the reasons was it was a way of caring for the poor. The law says the poor could go through on fallow ground and pick any apples that were there, or peaches, or any cucumbers that came up volunteer. Peas are likely to come up volunteer, or maybe carrots. And the poor people could come and have that on the land that lay fallow. And then at the end of the year, you plow under that whatever came, and you don't plow it under deep, but just, you know, break it into the soil, and it becomes nutrients for the soil. So those people who kept the Sabbath land rest for 42 years were benefited because there is a principle to be followed. There is a reason behind it. Another one, and this is in the second letter as well, deals with fruit trees. Why did God say not to use fruit from a newly planted tree? The Bible does not say. The commentators do not know. The historians do not know. But if you ask people who deal with fruits and vegetables and sell fruit trees today, they will say that it's good for the health of the tree, not only to not use the fruit for the first few years, but to clip off the blossoms. That's what's important, not even to let it grow fruit for the first few years. And that strengthens the tree. The nutrients that would normally go into producing the fruit go into producing the tree and make it strong. It lives longer. It produces better fruit over a longer period of time. Is it sin? Is it righteousness? It's a matter of productivity for the nation at the time, and today it's a matter of productivity. I was talking to a minister about this recently who had bought some blueberries, and with the blueberries came instructions to pinch off the blossoms for the first few years and not use them, not allow the fruit to grow, and that would make the plants stronger. Okay, now let's move on to the New Testament. I talk around this a little bit, and this deals with a statute, and this really, I think, settles the question, because this is a test statute, and that's the statute of circumcision. Cornelius came into the church, and his family came into the church. They received God's Spirit and were immediately baptized, and they did so without first being circumcised. Circumcision was a major factor in the religion of God. Even before there were statutes and judgments, when he made a covenant with Abraham in Genesis 17, he says, "This is the sign of my covenant with you, Abraham, the father of Israel, Abraham now the father of the faithful. The sign of the covenant is circumcision." When Israel went to keep the Passover, they had to be circumcised, and anybody who wanted to keep the Passover had to be circumcised and keep the religion of Israel. You find that in Exodus chapter 12 in the last several verses. When Joshua brought the Israelites into the land, they had not practiced circumcision for 40 years, which is interesting. I mean, God says keep all these statutes and judgments, and you had priests and Moses and Aaron, and how did circumcision get by? I don't know. There's some details that we have yet to know, but we do know that when Joshua went into the promised land, all of the men were circumcised, and it was very important. And then in Leviticus chapter 12, you can read, and I think it's verse 43, verse 3. Leviticus 12, verse 3, on the eighth day, a male child shall be circumcised. It is a statute, and not only a statute, wow, does it ever have a history. So we come to the New Testament Church of God, and there were a group of Jews, relatively small perhaps, in comparison to the entire church, but a large enough group that they created quite a controversy. They demanded that the church needed to keep the statute, and not only the statute, but the laws of Moses, as you read that in Acts chapter 15. If a case could be made for keeping the circumcision statute, where would it stop? Similar arguments could be made for keeping all of the statutes, any of the statutes that you find in the Old Testament. And not only the statutes, but the oral traditions. What did I read to you about the meaning of the word statute? It is what is spoken or what is written. It's whatever comes from God. So at the time, the rabbis could argue, the Jewish community could argue, well, these are the traditions that came from God. Therefore, they must be kept by the church of God. There would be almost no end to all the rules and regulations that should be followed by the church. So you know what happened in Acts 15. This was all considered by the church, by the ministry. I'm sure there was a prayer and fasting that went into it. And the church decided, no. The statute of circumcision should not be kept. And with that is a precedent for all of the other statutes. The Apostle Paul was inspired to confirm that God had rightly guided the early New Testament church leaders. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, he wrote a statement that does confirm this. And he wrote this to Corinth because Corinth was one of several church congregations that were troubled by Jews who went around, and I know we have these in almost every congregation. You get buttonholers who have their idea, their special idea, you know, this is what should be done. And these people went around, and they really troubled Corinth and caused a lot of trouble there. They did in Galatians as well. But Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 19, circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. Don't make too much of an issue of something that was completely symbolic, in other words. What is important, keeping the commandments of God is what matters. Therefore, circumcision was not a commandment of God. Boy, I sure could make a case if I were an attorney for the fact that circumcision was a commandment of God, but not according to God's inspiration and how he led the church. And I agree with that. I'm not disagreeing with it. But I'm just saying I understand. And I think you understand when you look at the scriptures and how strong the case could have been made for circumcision. But the important thing is keeping the commandments. And the interesting thing is when you read the Old Testament, God even showed in the Old Testament that that was what was involved with circumcision. You read in Deuteronomy 10:16. This is the Amplified Bible. So circumcise the foreskin of your minds and hearts, and be no longer stubborn and hardened. It's also repeated in Deuteronomy 30 and in Jeremiah 4. So even in the Old Testament, they understood principle as opposed to law. In conclusion, what we do in the church today is based upon the fact that the most important thing is obeying God's voice. Doing what he says to do. That's the basis for our teaching on statutes. We learn and make decisions from the biblical principles behind them, but we are governed by the continuing biblical laws.